our collective nightmare, they promised to show us the tapes. Then they acted like a magician who pulled a rabbit out of a hat and, when someone asked to see the rabbit again, claimed the rabbit never existed. The White House said the country would get the full video of a September strike on a suspected drug boat that left survivors dead. Then the promise fizzled into guarded statements, protocol checks, and a sudden fondness for national security euphemisms. That was fast, that was predictable. This began as a simple thing, a military operation, a video, a president saying the video would be released. The video that was released first, the neat early part, went up online in hours. The rest, the part that shows a second round of strikes and people left alive before they were killed, now sits under review like evidence in a film noir cabinet. The administration now says it needs to vet sensitive material. It speaks in the language of safety and secrecy while everyone remembers the other filing cabinet, the one labeled Epstein, and how promises of transparency were treated like optional reading. When a president says he will make something public, and then his administration acts like he never meant it, you either have incompetence or calculation. Either way, the damage is the same. People who might be culpable get extra time to tidy their stories. People inside and outside Congress are left to squint at pixelated frames and victory laps over partial footage. Experts whisper about potential war crimes. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle suddenly want the truth, or at least the video. A defense bill now tries to force the Defense Department to hand over unedited footage to armed services committees, with travel budgets dangled like a leash for disobedient officials. That is not the way a healthy democracy handles accountability. It's the way a circus manages a stampede, by closing the door and hoping the animals forget the smell. This is familiar theater. Promises of openness, made in bright light. Then, as attention focuses and consequences loom, a retreat into darkness and procedure. The same pattern played out with other sensitive documents, until the public learned that transparency is often negotiable, depending on what's at stake. The new twist is that some Republicans now demand release. Even allies are awkwardly nudging the administration to keep a promise it no longer seems comfortable keeping. The question is not just whether the video will come out. The question is why a government would promise one thing in front of TV cameras and then make a half-hearted show of keeping that promise when it might be inconvenient. The answer will be dressed up in legalese and classified jargon. The reality will be a notch more cynical. Promises are cheap. Covering your own tracks is not. This is America in 2025, a place where public pledges are performance pieces, where accountability is auctioned, and where the machinery of state will protect itself before it protects a citizen's right to know. The tape is the test. The response will tell us what mattered, the truth or the protection of those who ordered the strike and the people around them who would prefer the scene never be rewound. We are watching the country decide in slow motion whether it will honor a promise or repeat the old pattern of promising light and delivering blackout.
Timothée Chalamet and Kylie Jenner showed up to a premiere looking like a matched set from a very expensive IKEA. Same orange, same hardware, one of them carrying a ping pong paddle like it was a Birkin. It's charming, until you remember this wasn't about love so much as product placement wearing a tuxedo. They've mastered the modern celebrity move, vow extreme privacy, then stage a very public tableau that doubles as a billboard. Don't talk about each other in interviews. Just coordinate your wardrobe and let the cameras do the PR, it's romance, but make it a marketing channel. The couple wasn't just dating. They were a branded asset with a color palette. That orange isn't a color anymore, it's an ecosystem. Blimps, tracksuits, pop-ups. Every promo campaign now comes with its signature Pantone and a playlist. Remember Barbie Pink and the Charlie XCX Slime Green? Summer, those shades didn't signal taste, they signaled dominion. If you can own a hue, you own the cultural moment. Why debate ideas when you can fight over color rights? And the couples in unison thing is its own genre. Double denim, purple-themed weddings, matching leathers. Each look becomes the relationship's legacy like a viral heirloom. Breakup? At least your ex will have a museum-quality image to haunt them for decades. First world love now reads like an ad, curated intimacy, staged authenticity, and the weird afterlife of being forever remembered as an outfit. If heartbreak ever files for damages, it'll probably subpoena the Pantone chart.
Children across Australia woke up locked out of Instagram, TikTok, and half the internet they knew. The government called it a proud day. Kids taking back childhood, while governments and corporations take, in return, the right to scan faces and check IDs to prove those kids aren't 15. A world-first ban looks impressive on a press release. In practice, it hands tech giants a mandate to verify ages with live video selfies, emails, and documents. The same tools people worried would become routine surveillance. Platforms that complained about safety now get paid permission to peek deeper into users' lives and face punishments the size of small countries if they don't comply. The law says platforms must show reasonable steps to deactivate under 16 accounts. Platforms say they will, and also say it won't make kids safer. Some will suspend accounts, some will save the Botchern data for reactivation at 16, and some will quietly wait until January to act. Kids will be encouraged to report one another for lying about age. Parents can breathe easier while private companies tally facial data and issue compliance reports. No one will be punished for kids who flout the rules. Instead, a cottage industry of alternatives is growing overnight. New apps promising the same thrills without the tag banned are already hosting millions of Australians. The government's list of outlawed sites is changing like a game of whack-a-mole. Every time one hole is covered, another opens up. Unregulated corners of the internet are getting a steady flow of minors, exactly the opposite of the promised safety outcome. The eSafety Office says it will measure whether kids sleep more, read more, take fewer antidepressants, and go outside. That survey of childhood might sound humane if it didn't depend on a mass biometric experiment to get there. Stanford will audit the data, which is meant to lend credibility. Academic oversight is comforting, until you remember the academics are studying the effects of a policy that normalized mandatory age checks by private firms. The ban's rhetorical victory is clear. Politicians boxed up social media and called it protection. The trade-off is also clear. Governments and corporations now share a new routine for verifying who you are, starting with children. Free speech claims and privacy complaints will follow, and platforms that object will be fined until they comply or shapeshift into ways around the law. This isn't just a law about kids and phones. It's a quiet rebranding of surveillance as child protection. Parents get reassurance, companies get legal cover to expand biometric checks, and kids get pushed into corners with less oversight. Call it moral clarity. If moral clarity means solving a problem by building a system that will be used to solve more problems later.
This script is based on the CNN article titled Voyager 1. Voyager 1 is about to do something delightfully pointless and profoundly human. In November 2026, it will be one light day from Earth. That means a simple greeting, "Good morning, Voyager 1," sends a message that takes 24 hours to arrive and a full 48 hours for you to hear back. If patience had a monument, it would be a gold-plated antenna facing us from 16 billion miles away. Launched in 1977 and still cruising at 38,000 miles per hour, Voyager 1 is essentially on a decades-long road trip with no GPS updates, no passengers, and a playlist that occasionally cuts out. It's an interstellar space now, beyond the sun's magnetic bubble, living the dream of every retired thing. Slow, steady, and becoming more mysterious the less it reports. The probe communicates at 160 bits per second, dial-up modem speed for an object touring. The galaxy. Engineers gather its whispers with multiple giant antennas because the signal is faint and the universe is unsentimental. If something goes wrong, Voyager is old enough and clever enough to put itself in a safe state and wait politely for humans to call back. Think of it as an elderly neighbor who knows how to lock the door and make tea but can't be rushed. People on the Voyager team are turning off instruments and heaters to conserve power, deciding which parts of the probe get to live a little longer and which will be retired quietly. They point its antenna to Earth like someone holding a fragile conversation across an impossible distance. If propellant lines freeze and the antenna looks the wrong way, the conversation ends, and no amount of nostalgia will fix it. There's something wonderful and absurd about a machine built by humans being the last active ambassador of human curiosity. We send a tiny, fading object into the void with a record of who we thought we were in 1977, and now a mix of retirees and very young engineers shepherd it toward its 50th anniversary. The team's intergenerational dynamic is touching in a way only slightly less touching than the idea of a probe outliving the civilization that made it. Existentially, this raises two polite, uncomfortable questions. First, why bother? We'll get fewer bits of data than an old phone stores of photos, and the reply to a hello will arrive 2 days late. Second, what does it mean to send a message you will probably never hear answered in your lifetime? The probe's loneliness is a mirror. We cast capsules of ourselves outward. Golden records, dwindling instruments, carefully aimed antennas. Because we want something, somewhere, to keep a tally that we existed. In the end, Voyager 1 is a stubborn act of optimism performed in slow motion. It's us refusing to vanish quietly, even when the reply takes a day to arrive and costs more effort than sense. That's either the most human thing we do or the most cosmic bit of vanity. Either way, wave if you must. The plane of the planets has long since receded, but someone or something might get the message, and somewhere in that delay is the peculiar comfort of not being immediately forgotten.
Two billionaires squaring off over the carcass of an industry that used to make movies and report news. The auction is being staged like theater, complete with stage slights, tableside snubs, and legal letters written as press releases. Because in today's market, the spectacle of conflict can be worth as much as the assets themselves. Warner Brothers Discovery put its pieces on the block and watched the usual predators circle. Netflix, Comcast, and a bruising Come Loudly or Die Paramount, backed by Oracle money and family influence. The bids climb like feverish temperature checks. $19, $22, $25.50, $26.50, $27.75, $30. Each increment less about stewardship of culture than about swallowing scale. One offer courted an aging CEO's ego with titles and co-chair promises. Another carved the company in ways that made valuation math prettier for shareholders. Every move was performative, calibrated to please markets, lawyers, and the snacks tray at industry galas. This was not strategy so much as ritualized extraction. Paramount tried to buy everything, including newsrooms, betting that control and consolidation would buy scale and leverage. Netflix wanted the studio and streaming engine, leaving other parts to be valued separately. The board favored a narrower, tidier sale over an all-in takeover, and a hostile bid followed. Part grand gesture, part legal artillery, because etiquette in modern capitalism quickly gives way to litigation and shareholder theater. Egos, age gaps, and political patronage threaded the joust. A younger CEO with a screenwriter's bravado pushed aggressively. A veteran boss, flattered with co-lead offers, kept his distance long enough to let the price rise. Family money and connections to power brokers lurk in the whole background like a financing subtext. A reminder that regulatory reviews are often a chess game between private fortunes and public institutions. Everything that mattered about content, the people who make it, the journalistic missions, the cultural stewardship, became negotiable line items. CNN and similar outlets were treated as appendages to be bundled or spun off according to balance sheet convenience. Legal missives and PR, crafted righteousness, substituted for real accountability. Public dinners became stages for avoidance rather than conversation. Respect and admiration were typed into texts, while boardrooms arranged who would own which rights next quarter. This is not merely a fight over shares. It is a symptom of a market that has monetized attention to the point that storytelling is now an asset class. Newsrooms are liabilities to be trimmed, and cultural heritage is parceled for immediate return. The auction's choreography, hostile bids, carve-outs, ego placations, political wiring, reveals an industry hollowed out by consolidation and shaped by the imperatives of profit above craft. The result is less a future for Hollywood than a ledger. What can be squeezed, sold, split, and syndicated before anyone remembers why it mattered.